This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents Some Everyday Thoughts by C.S. Lewis, edited by Leslie Walmsley. This book is read by Ralph Cosham. 109. The Necessity of Chivalry. Published as Notes on the Way in Time and Tide, Volume 21, 17th of August 1940, this was reprinted as The Importance of an Ideal in Living Age, Volume 3, 59, October 1940, and as The Necessity of Chivalry in Present Concerns, 1991. The word chivalry has meant, at different times, a good many different things, from heavy cavalry to giving a woman a seat in a train. But if we want to understand chivalry as an ideal distinct from other ideals, if we want to isolate that particular conception of a man comme il faut, which was the special contribution of the Middle Ages to our culture, we cannot do better than turn to the words addressed to the greatest of all the imaginary knights in Malory's Mort d'Arthur. "Thou wert the meekest man," says the rector to the dead Lancelot. "Thou wert the meekest man that ever ate in hall among ladies, and thou wert the sternest knight to thy mortal foe that ever put spear in the rest." The important thing about this ideal is, of course, the double demand it makes on human nature. The knight is a man of blood and iron, a man familiar with the sight of smashed faces and the ragged stumps of lopped-off limbs. He is also a demure, almost a maiden-like guest in hall, a gentle, modest, unobtrusive man. He is not a compromise or happy mean between ferocity and meekness. He is fierce to the nth, and meek to the nth. When Lancelot heard himself pronounced the best knight in the world, he wept as he had been a child that had been beaten. What, you may ask, is the relevance of this ideal to the modern world? It is terribly relevant. It may or may not be practicable. The Middle Ages notoriously failed to obey it. But it is certainly practical. Practical is the fact that men in a desert must find water or die. Let us be quite clear that the ideal is a paradox. Most of us, having grown up among the ruins of the chivalrous tradition, were taught in our youth that a bully is always a coward. Our first week at school refuted this lie, along with its corollary that a truly brave man is always gentle. It is a pernicious lie, because it misses the real novelty and originality of the medieval demand upon human nature. Worse still, it represents, as a natural fact, something which is really a human ideal, nowhere fully attained, and nowhere attained at all without arduous discipline. It is refuted by history and experience. Homer's Achilles knows nothing of the demand that the brave should also be the modest and the merciful. He kills men as they cry for quarter, or takes them prisoner to kill them at leisure. The heroes of the sagas know nothing of it. They are as stern to inflict as they are stubborn to endure. Attila had a custom of fiercely rolling his eyes as if he wished to enjoy the terror which he inspired. Even the Romans, when gallant enemies fell into their hands, led them through the streets for a show, and cut their throats in cellars when the show was over. At school, we found that the hero of the first 15 might well be a noisy, arrogant, overbearing bully. In the last war, we often found that the man who was invaluable in a show was a man for whom in peacetime we could not easily find room except in Dartmoor. Such is heroism by nature, heroism outside the chivalrous tradition. The medieval ideal brought together two things which have no natural tendency to gravitate towards one another. It brought them together for that very reason. It taught humility and forbearance to the great warrior, because everyone knew by experience how much he usually needed that lesson. It demanded valour of the urbane and modest man, because everyone knew that he was as likely as not to be a milksop. In doing so, the Middle Ages fixed on the one hope of the world. It may or may not be possible to produce by the thousand men who combine the two sides of Lancelot's character. But if it is not possible, then all talk of any lasting happiness or dignity in human society is pure moonshine. If we cannot produce Lancelots, humanity falls into two sections: those who can deal in blood and iron, but cannot be meek in hall, and those who are meek in hall but useless in battle. For the third class, who are both brutal in peace and cowardly in war, need not here be discussed. When this dissociation of the two halves of Lancelot occurs, history becomes a horribly simple affair. The ancient history of the Near East is like that. Hardy barbarians swarm down from their highlands and obliterate a civilization. Then they become civilized themselves and go soft. Then a new wave of barbarians comes down and obliterates them. Then the cycle begins over again. Modern machinery will not change this cycle. It will only enable the same thing to happen on a larger scale. Indeed, nothing much else can ever happen if the stern and the meek fall into two mutually exclusive classes. And never forget that this is their natural condition. The man who combines both characters, the knight, is a work not of nature, but of art, of that art which has human beings instead of canvas or marble for its medium. In the world today there is a liberal or enlightened tradition which regards the combative side of man's nature as a pure atavistic evil, and scouts the chivalrous sentiment as part of the false glamour of war. And there is also a neo-heroic tradition which scouts the chivalrous sentiment as a weak sentimentality, which would raise from its grave, its shallow and unquiet grave, the pre-Christian ferocity of Achilles by a modern invocation. Already in our own Kipling, the heroic qualities of his favourite subalterns are dangerously removed from meekness and urbanity. One cannot quite imagine the adult Stalky in the same room with the best of Nelson's captains, still less with Sidney. These two tendencies between them weave the world's shroud. Happily, we live better than we write, better than we deserve. Lancelot is not yet irrecoverable. To some of us, this war brought a glorious surprise in the discovery that, after 20 years of cynicism and cocktails, the heroic virtues were still unimpaired in the younger generation, and ready for exercise the moment they were called upon. Yet with this sternness there is much meekness. From all I hear, the young pilots in the RAF, to whom we owe our life from hour to hour, are not less but more urbane and modest than the 1915 model. In short, there is still life in the tradition which the Middle Ages inaugurated. But the maintenance of that life depends, in part, on knowing that the knightly character is art, not nature, something that needs to be achieved, not something that can be relied upon to happen. And this knowledge is specially necessary as we grow more democratic. In previous centuries, the vestiges of chivalry were kept alive by a specialized class, from whom they spread to other classes, partly by imitation and partly by coercion. And now, it seems, the people must either be chivalrous on its own resources or else choose between the two remaining alternatives of brutality and softness. This is, indeed, part of the general problem of a classless society, which is too seldom mentioned. Will its ethos be a synthesis of what was best in all the classes, or a mere pool, with the sediment of all and the virtues of none? But that is too large a subject for the fag end of an article. My theme is chivalry. I have tried to show that this old tradition is practical and vital. The ideal embodied in Lancelot is escapism, in a sense never dreamed of by those who use that word. It offers the only possible escape from a world divided between wolves who do not understand and sheep who cannot defend the things which make life desirable. There was, to be sure, a rumour in the last century that wolves would gradually become extinct by some natural process. But this seems to have been an exaggeration. 110. The Inner Ring. A memorial oration delivered at King's College, the University of London, in 1944, this first appeared in They Asked for a Paper, 1962, and is now in Screwtape Proposes a Toast, 1998. May I read you a few lines from Tolstoy's War and Peace? When Boris entered the room, Prince Andrei was listening to an old general, wearing his decorations, who was reporting something to Prince Andrei with an expression of soldierly servility on his purple face. "All right, please wait," he said to the general. speaking in Russian with the French accent which he used when he spoke with contempt. The moment he noticed Boris, he stopped listening to the general, who trotted imploringly after him and begged to be heard, while Prince Andrei turned to Boris with a cheerful smile and a nod of the head. Boris now clearly understood, what he had already guessed, that side by side with the system of discipline and subordination which were laid down in the army regulations, there existed a different and a more real system, the system which compelled a tightly laced general with a purple face to wait respectfully for his turn, while a mere captain like Prince Andrei chatted with a mere second lieutenant like Boris. Boris decided at once that he would be guided not by the official system, but by this other unwritten system. When you invite a middle-aged moralist to address you, I suppose I must conclude, however unlikely the conclusion seems, that you have a taste for middle-aged moralizing. I shall do my best to gratify it. I shall, in fact, give you advice about the world in which you are going to live. I do not mean by this that I am going to attempt a talk on what are called current affairs. You probably know quite as much about them as I do. I am not going to tell you, except in a form so general that you will hardly recognize it, what part you ought to play in post-war reconstruction. It is not, in fact, very likely that any of you will be able, in the next 10 years, to make any direct contribution to the peace or prosperity of Europe. You will be busy finding jobs, getting married, acquiring facts. I am going to do something more old-fashioned than you perhaps expected. I am going to give advice. I am going to issue warnings. Advice and warnings about things which are so perennial that no one calls them current affairs. And of course, everyone knows what a middle-aged moralist of my type warns his juniors against. He warns them against the world, the flesh, and the devil. But one of this trio will be enough to deal with today. The devil I shall leave strictly alone. The association between him and me in the public mind has already gone quite as deep as I wish. In some quarters, it has already reached the level of confusion, if not of identification. I begin to realize the truth of the old proverb that he who sups with that formidable host needs a long spoon. As for the flesh, you must be very abnormal young people if you do not know quite as much about it as I do. But on the world, I think I have something to say. In the passage I have just read from Tolstoy, the young second lieutenant, Boris Dobretskoy, discovers that there exist in the army two different systems or hierarchies. The one is printed in some little red book, and anyone can easily read it up. It also remains constant. A general is always superior to a colonel, and a colonel to a captain. The other is not printed anywhere. Nor is it even a formally organized secret society with officers and rules, which you would be told after you had been admitted. You are never formally and explicitly admitted by anyone. You discover gradually, in almost indefinable ways, that it exists, and that you are outside it. And then later, perhaps, that you are inside it. There are what correspond to passwords, but they too are spontaneous and informal. A particular slang, the use of particular nicknames, an elusive manner of conversation are the marks. But it is not constant. It is not easy, even at a given moment, to say who is inside and who is outside. Some people are obviously in and some are obviously out, but there are always several on the borderline. And if you come back to the same divisional headquarters or brigade headquarters or the same regiment or even the same company after 6 weeks' absence, you may find this second hierarchy quite altered. There are no formal admissions or expulsions. People think they are in it after they have, in fact, been pushed out of it, or before they have been allowed in. This provides great amusement for those who are really inside. It has no fixed name. The only certain rule is that the insiders and outsiders call it by different names. From inside it may be designated, in simple cases, by mere enumeration. It may be called you and Tony and me. When it is very secure and comparatively stable in membership, it calls itself we. When it has to be suddenly expanded to meet a particular emergency, it calls itself all the sensible people at this place. From outside, if you have despaired of getting into it, you call it that gang, or they, or so-and-so and his set, or the caucus, or the inner ring. If you are a candidate for admission, you probably don't call it anything. To discuss it with the other outsiders would make you feel outside yourself. And to mention it in talking to the man who is inside, and who may help you in if this present conversation goes well, would be madness. Badly as I may have described it, I hope you will all have recognized the thing I am describing. Not, of course, that you have been in the Russian army, or perhaps in any army. But you have met the phenomenon of an inner ring. You discovered one in your house at school before the end of the first term. And when you had climbed up to somewhere near it by the end of your second year, perhaps you discovered that within the ring there was a ring yet more inner, which in turn was the fringe of the great school ring to which the house rings were only satellites. It is even possible that the school ring was almost in touch with the master's ring. You were beginning, in fact, to pierce through the skins of the onion. And here, too, at your university. Shall I be wrong in assuming that at this very moment, invisible to me, there are several rings, independent systems or concentric rings, present in this room? And I can assure you that in whatever hospital, inn of court, diocese, school, business, or college you arrive after going down, you will find the rings, what Tolstoy calls the second or unwritten systems. All this is rather obvious. I wonder whether you will say the same of my next step, which is this. I believe that in all men's lives at certain periods, and in many men's lives at all periods between infancy and extreme old age, one of the most dominant elements is the desire to be inside the local ring and the terror of being left outside. This desire, in one of its forms, has indeed had ample justice done to it in literature. I mean in the form of snobbery. A Victorian fiction is full of characters who are hag-ridden by the desire to get inside that particular ring which is, or was, called society. But it must be clearly understood that society, in that sense of the word, is merely one of 100 rings, and snobbery therefore only one form of the longing to be inside. People who believe themselves to be free, and indeed are free from snobbery, and who read satires on snobbery with tranquil superiority, may be devoured by the desire in another form. It may be the very intensity of their desire to enter some quite different ring, which renders them immune from the allurements of high life. An invitation from a duchess would be very cold comfort to a man smarting under the sense of exclusion from some artistic or communist coterie. Poor man, it is not large, lighted rooms or champagne, or even scandals about peers and cabinet ministers that he wants. It is the sacred little attic or studio, the heads bent together, the fog of tobacco smoke, and the delicious knowledge that we four or five all huddled beside this stove, are the people who know. Often the desire conceals itself so well that we hardly recognize the pleasures of fruition. Men tell not only their wives, but themselves, that it is a hardship to stay late at the office or the school, on some bit of important extra work which they have been let in for, because they and so-and-so and the two others are the only people left in the place who really know how things are run. But it is not quite true. It is a terrible bore, of course, when old Fatty Smithson draws you aside and whispers, "Look here, we've got to get you in on this examination somehow." Or, "Charles and I saw at once that you've got to be in on this committee." A terrible bore. Ah, but how much more terrible if you were left out. It is tiring and unhealthy to lose your Saturday afternoons, but to have them free because you don't matter, that is much worse. Freud would say, no doubt, that the whole thing is a subterfuge of the sexual impulse. I wonder whether the shoe is not sometimes on the other foot. I wonder whether, in ages of promiscuity, many a virginity has not been lost less in obedience to Venus than in obedience to the lure of the caucus. For, of course, when promiscuity is the fashion, the chaste are outsiders. They are ignorant of something that other people know. They are uninitiated. And as for lighter matters, the numbers who first smoked or first got drunk for a similar reason is probably very large. I must now make a distinction. I am not going to say that the existence of inner rings is an evil. It is certainly unavoidable. There must be confidential discussions, And it is not only not a bad thing, it is, in itself, a good thing that personal friendship should grow up between those who work together. And it is perhaps impossible that the official hierarchy of any organization should quite coincide with its actual workings. If the wisest and most energetic people invariably held the highest posts, it might coincide. Since they often do not, there must be people in high positions who are really deadweights, and people in lower positions who are more important than their rank and seniority would lead you to suppose. In that way, the second unwritten system is bound to grow up. It is necessary, and perhaps it is not a necessary evil. But the desire which draws us into inner rings is another matter. A thing may be morally neutral, and yet the desire for that thing may be dangerous. As Byron has said, "Sweet is a legacy, and passing sweet the unexpected death of some old lady." The painless death of a pious relative at an advanced age is not an evil, but an earnest desire for her death on the part of her heirs is not reckoned a proper feeling, and the law frowns on even the gentlest attempt to expedite her departure. Let inner rings be an unavoidable and even an innocent feature of life, though certainly not a beautiful one. But what of our longing to enter them, our anguish when we are excluded, and the kind of pleasure we feel when we get in? I have no right to make assumptions about the degree to which any of you may already be compromised. I must not assume that you have ever first neglected and finally shaken off friends whom you really loved and who might have lasted you a lifetime in order to court the friendship of those who appeared to you more important, more esoteric. I must not ask whether you have ever derived actual pleasure from the loneliness and humiliation of the outsiders after you yourself were in, whether you have talked to fellow members of the ring in the presence of outsiders simply in order that the outsiders might envy, whether the means whereby, in your days of probation, you propitiated the inner ring were always wholly admirable. I will ask only one question, and it is, of course, a rhetorical question which expects no answer. In the whole of your life, as you now remember it, has the desire to be on the right side of that invisible line ever prompted you to any act or word on which, in the cold, small hours of a wakeful night, you can look back with satisfaction? If so, your case is more fortunate than most. But I said I was going to give advice, and advice should deal with the future, not the past. I have hinted at the past only to awake you to what I believe to be the real nature of human life. I don't believe that the economic motive and the erotic motive account for everything that goes on in what we moralists call the world. Even if you add ambition, I think the picture is still incomplete. The lust for the esoteric, the longing to be inside, take many forms which are not easily recognizable as ambition. We hope, no doubt, for tangible profits from every inner ring we penetrate. Power, money, liberty to break rules, avoidance of routine duties, evasion of discipline. But all these would not satisfy us if we did not get in addition the delicious sense of secret intimacy. It is, no doubt, a great convenience to know that we need fear no official reprimands from our official senior, because he is old Percy, a fellow member of our ring. But we don't value the intimacy only for the sake of convenience. Quite equally, we value the convenience as a proof of the intimacy. My main purpose in this address is simply to convince you that this desire is one of the great permanent mainsprings of human action. It is one of the factors which go to make up the world as we know it, this whole pell-mell of struggle, competition, confusion, graft, disappointment, and advertisement. And if it is one of the permanent mainsprings, then you may be quite sure of this. Unless you take measures to prevent it, this desire is going to be one of the chief motives of your life, from the first day on which you enter your profession until the day when you are too old to care. That will be the natural thing, the life that will come to you of its own accord. Any other kind of life, if you lead it, will be the result of conscious and continuous effort. If you do nothing about it, if you drift with the stream, you will, in fact, be an inner ringer. I don't say you'll be a successful one, that's as maybe. But whether by pining and moping outside rings that you can never enter, or by passing triumphantly further and further in, one way or the other, you will be that kind of man. I have already made it fairly clear that I think it better for you not to be that kind of man. But you may have an open mind on the question. I will therefore suggest two reasons for thinking as I do. It would be polite and charitable, and in view of your age reasonable too, to suppose that none of you is yet a scoundrel. On the other hand, by the mere law of averages, I am saying nothing against free will, it is almost certain that at least two or three of you before you die will have become something very like scoundrels. There must be, in this room, the makings of at least that number of unscrupulous, treacherous, ruthless egotists. The choice is still before you, and I hope you will not take my hard words about your possible future characters as a token of disrespect to your present characters. And the prophecy I make is this. To 9 out of 10 of you, the choice which could lead to scoundrelism will come, when it does come, in no very dramatic colours. Obviously bad men, obviously threatening or bribing, will almost certainly not appear. Over a drink or a cup of coffee, disguised as a triviality and sandwiched between two jokes from the lips of a man or woman whom you have recently been getting to know rather better and whom you hope to know better still, just at the moment when you are most anxious not to appear crude or naive or a prig, the hint will come. It will be the hint of something which is not quite in accordance with the technical rules of fair play, something which the public, the ignorant, romantic public, would never understand, something which even the outsiders in your own profession are apt to make a fuss about. But something, says your new friend, which we, and at the word we you try not to blush for mere pleasure, something we always do. And you will be drawn in, if you are drawn in, not by desire for gain or ease, but simply because at that moment, when the cup was so near your lips, you cannot bear to be thrust back again into the cold outer world. It would be so terrible to see the other man's face, that genial, confidential, delightfully sophisticated face, turn suddenly cold and contemptuous, to know that you had been tried for the inner ring and rejected. And then, if you are drawn in, next week it will be something a little further from the rules, and next year something further still, but all in the jolliest, friendliest spirit. It may end in a crash, a scandal, and penal servitude. It may end in millions, a peerage, and giving prizes at your old school. But you will be a scoundrel. That is my first reason. Of all passions, the passion for the inner ring is most skilful in making a man, who is not yet a very bad man, do very bad things. My second reason is this. The torture allotted to the Danaids in the classical underworld, that of attempting to fill sieves with water, is the symbol not of one vice, but of all vices. It is the very mark of a perverse desire that it seeks what is not to be had. The desire to be inside the invisible line illustrates this rule. As long as you are governed by that desire, you will never get what you want. You are trying to peel an onion. If you succeed, there will be nothing left. Until you conquer the fear of being an outsider you will remain. This is surely very clear when you come to think of it. If you want to be made free of a certain circle for some wholesome reason, if, say, you want to join a musical society because you really like music, then there is a possibility of satisfaction. You may find yourself playing in a quartet, and you may enjoy it. But if all you want is to be in the know, your pleasure will be short-lived. The circle cannot have from within the charm it had from outside. By the very act of admitting you, it has lost its magic. Once the first novelty is worn off, the members of this circle will be no more interesting than your old friends. Why should they be? You were not looking for virtue, or kindness, or loyalty, or humour, or learning, or wit, or any of the things that can be really enjoyed. You merely wanted to be in, and that is a pleasure that cannot last. As soon as your new associates have been stale to you by custom, you will be looking for another ring. The rainbow's end will still be ahead of you. The old ring will now be only the drab background for your endeavour to enter the new one. And you will always find them hard to enter, for a reason you very well know. You yourself, once you are in, want to make it hard for the next entrant, just as those who are already in made it hard for you. Naturally. In any wholesome group of people which holds together for a good purpose, the exclusions are, in a sense, accidental. Three or four people who are together for the sake of some piece of work exclude others because there is work only for so many, or because the others can't, in fact, do it. Your little musical group limits its numbers because the rooms they meet in are only so big. But your genuine inner ring exists for exclusion. There'd be no fun if there were no outsiders. The invisible line would have no meaning unless most people were on the wrong side of it. Exclusion is no accident. It is the essence. The quest of the inner ring will break your hearts unless you break it. But if you break it, a surprising result will follow. If, in your working hours, you make the work your end, you will presently find yourself, all unawares, inside the only circle in your profession that really matters. You will be one of the sound craftsmen, and other sound craftsmen will know it. This group of craftsmen will by no means coincide with the inner ring, or the important people, or the people in the know. It will not shape that professional policy, or work up that professional influence which fights for the profession as a whole against the public. Nor will it lead to those periodic scandals and crises which the inner ring produces. But it will do those things which that profession exists to do, and will, in the long run, be responsible for all the respect which that profession in fact enjoys, and which the speeches and advertisements cannot maintain. And if, in your spare time, you consort simply with the people you like, you will again find that you have come, unawares, to a real inside. That you are indeed snug and safe at the centre of something which, seen from without, would look exactly like an inner ring. But the difference is that its secrecy is accidental, and its exclusiveness a byproduct. And no one was led thither by the lure of the esoteric. For it is only four or five people who like one another, meeting to do things that they like. This is friendship. Aristotle placed it among the virtues. It causes perhaps half of all the happiness in the world, and no inner ring can ever have it. We are told in Scripture that those who ask get. That is true, in senses I can't now explore. But in another sense, there is much truth in the schoolboy's principle, them as asks shan't have. To a young person, just entering on adult life, the world seems full of insides, full of delightful intimacies and confidentialities, and he desires to enter them. But if he follows that desire, he will reach no inside that is worth reaching. The true road lies in quite another direction. It is like the house in Alice Through the Looking Glass.
111. Two Lectures.
Published as Who Was Right, Dream Lecturer or Real Lecturer, in the Coventry Evening Telegraph, 21st of February, 1945, and reproduced as Two Lectures in Undeceptions, 1971, this was reprinted in First and Second Things, 1985. "And so," said the lecturer, "I end where I began. Evolution, development, the slow struggle upwards and onwards from crude and inchoate beginnings towards ever-increasing perfection and elaboration, that appears to be the very formula of the whole universe. We see it exemplified in everything we study. The oak comes from the acorn. The giant express engine of today comes from the rocket. The highest achievements of contemporary art are in a continuous line of descent from the rude scratchings with which prehistoric man adorned the wall of his cave. What are the ethics and philosophy of civilized man but a miraculous elaboration of the most primitive instincts and savage taboos? Each one of us has grown through slow prenatal stages in which we were at first more like fish than mammals, from a particle of matter too small to be seen. Man himself springs from beasts, the organic from the inorganic. Development is the key word. The march of all things is from lower to higher." And none of this, of course, was new to me or to anyone else in the audience, but it was put very well, much better than it appears in my reproduction, and the whole voice and figure of the lecturer were impressive. At least they must have impressed me, for otherwise I cannot account for the curious dream I had that night. I dreamed that I was still at the lecture, and the voice from the platform was still going on. But it was saying all the wrong things. At least it may have been saying the right things up to the very moment at which I began attending, but it certainly began going wrong after that. What I remember on waking went like this. Appears to be the very formula of the whole universe. We see it exemplified in everything we study. The acorn comes from a full-grown oak. The first crude engine, the rocket, comes not from a still cruder engine, but from something much more perfect than itself and much more complex, the mind of a man and a man of genius. The first prehistoric drawings come not from earlier scratchings, but from the hand and brain of human beings whose hand and brain cannot be shown to have been in any way inferior to our own. And indeed, it is obvious that the man who first conceived the idea of making a picture must have been a greater genius than any of the artists who have succeeded him. The embryo with which the life of each one of us began did not originate from something even more embryonic. It originated from two full-developed human beings, our parents. Descent, downward movement, is the key word. The march of all things is from higher to lower. The rude and imperfect thing always springs from something perfect and developed. I did not think much of this while I was shaving, but it so happened that I had no 10 o'clock pupil that morning, and when I had finished answering my letters, I sat down and reflected on my dream. It appeared to me that the dream lecturer had a good deal to be said for him. It is true that we do not see all round us things growing up to perfection from small and rude beginnings. But then it is equally true that the small and rude beginnings themselves always come from some full-grown and developed thing. All adults were once babies, true, but then babies were begotten and born by adults. Corn does come from seed, but then seed comes from corn. I could even give the dream lecturer an example he had missed. All civilizations grow from small beginnings. But when you look into it, you always find that those small beginnings themselves have been dropped, as an oak drops an acorn, by some other and mature civilization. The weapons and even the cookery of old Germanic barbarism are, so to speak, driftwood from the wrecked ship of Roman civilization. The starting point of Greek culture is the remains of olden Minoan cultures, supplemented by oddments from civilized Egypt and Phoenicia. But in that case, thought I, what about the first civilization of all? As soon as I asked this question, I realized that the dream lecturer had been choosing his examples rather cautiously. He had talked only about things we can see going on around us. He had kept off the subject of absolute beginnings. He had quite correctly pointed out that in the present and in the historical past, we see imperfect life coming from perfect just as much as vice versa. But he hadn't even attempted to answer the real lecturer about the beginnings of all life. The real lecturer's view was that when you got back far enough, back into those parts of the past which we know less about, you would find an absolute beginning, and it would be something small and imperfect. That was a point in favor of the real lecturer. He at least had a theory about the absolute beginning, whereas the dream lecturer had slurred it over. But hadn't the real lecturer done a little slurring, too? He had not given us a hint that his theory of the ultimate origins involved us in believing that nature's habits have, since those days, altered completely. Her present habits show us an endless cycle, the bird coming from the egg and the egg from the bird. But he asked us to believe that the whole thing started with an egg which had been preceded by no bird. Perhaps it did. But the whole prima facie plausibility of his view, the ease with which the audience accepted it as something natural and obvious, depended on his slurring over the immense difference between this and the processes we actually observe. He put it over by drawing our attention to the fact that eggs develop into birds, and making us forget that birds lay eggs. Indeed, we have been trained to do this all our lives, trained to look at the universe with one eye shut. Developmentalism is made to look plausible by a kind of trick. For the first time in my life, I began to look at the question with both eyes open. In the world I know, the perfect produces the imperfect, which again becomes perfect. Egg leads to bird, and bird to egg, in endless succession. If there ever was a life which sprang of its own accord out of purely inorganic universe, or a civilization which raised itself by its own shoulder straps out of pure savagery, then this event was totally unlike the beginnings of every subsequent life and every subsequent civilization. The thing may have happened, but all its plausibility is gone. On any view, the first beginning must have been outside the ordinary processes of nature. An egg which came from no bird is no more natural than a bird which had existed from all eternity. And since the egg-bird-egg sequence leads us to no plausible beginning, is it not reasonable to look for the real origin somewhere outside the sequence altogether? You have to go outside the sequence of engines into the world of men to find the real originator of the rocket. Is it not equally reasonable to look outside nature for the real originator of the natural order?
112. Some Thoughts.
Written at the request of the medical missionaries of Mary, who founded Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital at Drogheda, Ireland, this was published in The First Decade, 10 years' work of the medical missionaries of Mary, at the sign of the Three Candles, Dublin, 1948. Reproduced in Undeceptions, 1971, and First and Second Things, 1985. It is now in Compelling Reason, 1998. At first sight, nothing seems more obvious than that religious persons should care for the sick. No Christian building, except perhaps a church, is more self-explanatory than a Christian hospital. Yet on further consideration, the thing is really connected with the undying paradox, the blessedly two-edged character of Christianity. And if any of us were now encountering Christianity for the first time, he would be vividly aware of this paradox. Let us suppose that such a person began by observing those Christian activities which are, in a sense, directed towards this present world. He would find that this religion had, as a mere matter of historical fact, been the agent which preserved such secular civilization as survived the fall of the Roman Empire, that to it Europe owes the salvation, in those perilous ages, of civilized agriculture, architecture, laws, and literacy itself. He would find that this same religion has always been healing the sick and caring for the poor, that it has, more than any other, blessed marriage, and that arts and philosophy tend to flourish in its neighbourhood. In a word, it is always either doing, or at least repenting with shame for not having done, all the things which secular humanitarianism enjoins. If our inquirer stopped at this point, he would have no difficulty in classifying Christianity, giving it its place on a map of the great religions. Obviously, he would say, this is one of the world-affirming religions like Confucianism, or the agricultural religions of the great Mesopotamian city-states. But how if our inquiry began, as he well might, with quite a different series of Christian phenomena? He might notice that the central image in all Christian art was that of a man slowly dying by torture, that the instrument of his torture was the worldwide symbol of the faith, that martyrdom was almost the specifically Christian action, that our calendar was as full of fasts as of feasts, that we meditated constantly on the mortality not only of ourselves, but of the whole universe, that we were bidden to entrust all our treasure to another world, and that even a certain disdain for the whole natural order, contemptus mundi, had sometimes been reckoned a Christian virtue. And here, once again, if he knew no more, the inquirer would find Christianity quite easy to classify. But this time he would classify it as one of the world-denying religions. It would be pigeonholed along with Buddhism. Either conclusion would be justified if a man had only the one or the other half of the evidence before him. It is when he puts both halves together and sees that Christianity cuts right across the classification he was attempting to make, it is then that he first knows what he is up against, and I think he will be bewildered. Probably most of those who read this page have been Christians all their lives. If so, they may find it hard to sympathize with the bewilderment I refer to. To Christians, the explanation of this two-edged character in their faith seems obvious. They live in a graded or hierarchical universe where there is a place for everything, and everything should be kept in its right place. The supernatural is higher than the natural, but each has its place. Just as a man is higher than a dog, but a dog has its place. It is, therefore, to us not at all surprising that healing for the sick and provision for the poor should be less important than, when they are, as sometimes happens, alternative to the salvation of souls, and yet very important. Because God created the natural, invented it out of his love and artistry, it demands our reverence. Because it is only a creature and not he, it is, from another point of view, of little account. And still more, because nature, and especially human nature, is fallen, it must be corrected, and the evil within it must be mortified. But its essence is good. Correction is something quite different from Manichaean repudiation or Stoic superiority. Hence, in all true Christian asceticism, that respect for the thing rejected, which, I think, we never find in pagan asceticism. Marriage is good, though not for me. Wine is good, though I must not drink it. Feasts are good, though today we fast. This attitude will, I think, be found to depend logically on the doctrines of the creation and the fall. Some hazy adumbrations of a doctrine of the fall can be found in paganism. But it is quite astonishing how rarely outside Christianity we find, I am not sure that we ever find, a real doctrine of creation. In polytheism, the gods are usually the product of a universe already in existence. Keats' Hyperion, in spirit, if not in detail, is true enough as a picture of pagan theogony. In pantheism, the universe is never something that God made. It is an emanation, something that oozes out of him, or an appearance, something he looks like to us but really is not, or even an attack of incurable schizophrenia from which he is unaccountably suffering. Polytheism is always, in the long run, nature worship. Pantheism is always, in the long run, hostility to nature. None of these beliefs really leaves you free both to enjoy your breakfast and to mortify your inordinate appetites, much less to mortify appetites recognized as innocent at present, lest they should become inordinate. And none of them leaves anyone free to do what is being done in the Lord's hospital every day, to fight against death as earnestly, skillfully, and calmly as if you were a secular humanitarian, while knowing all the time that death is, both for better and worse, something that the secular humanitarian has never dreamed of. The world, knowing how all our real investments are beyond the grave, might expect us to be less concerned than other people who go in for what is called higher thought, and tell us that death doesn't matter. But we are not high-minded, and we follow one who stood and wept at the grave of Lazarus. Not surely because he was grieved that Mary and Martha wept and sorrowed for their lack of faith, though some thus interpret, but because death, the punishment of sin, is even more horrible in his eyes than in ours. The nature which he had created as God, the nature which he had assumed as man, lay there before him in its ignominy, a foul smell, food for worms. Though he was to revive it a moment later, he wept at the shame. If I may here quote a writer of my own communion, I am not so much afraid of death as ashamed of it. And that brings us again to the paradox. Of all men, we hope most of death. Yet nothing will reconcile us to, well, its unnaturalness. We know that we were not made for it. We know how it crept into our destiny as an intruder. And we know who had defeated it. Because our Lord is risen, we know that on one level it is an enemy already disarmed. But because we know that the natural level also is God's creation, we cannot cease to fight against the death which mars it, as against all those other blemishes upon it, against pain and poverty, barbarism and ignorance. Because we love something else more than this world, we love even this world better than those who know no other. 1.13. Xmas and Christmas. A lost chapter from Herodotus. This was first published in Time and Tide, volume 35, the 4th of December 1954, and reprinted in Undeceptions, 1971, and First and Second Things, 1985, and is now in Compelling Reason, 1998. And beyond this there lies in the ocean, turned towards the west and north, the island of Niaturb, which Hecateus indeed declares to be the same size and shape as Sicily, but it is larger, though in calling it triangular a man would not miss the mark. It is densely inhabited by men who wear clothes not very different from the other barbarians who occupy the northwestern parts of Europe, though they do not agree with them in language. These islanders, surpassing all the men of whom we know in patience and endurance, use the following customs. In the middle of winter, when fogs and rains most abound, they have a great festival which they call Xmas, and for 50 days they prepare for it in the fashion I shall describe. First of all, every citizen is obliged to send to each of his friends and relations a square piece of hard paper stamped with a picture, which in their speech is called an Xmas card. But the pictures represent birds sitting on branches, or trees with a dark green prickly leaf, or else men in such garments as the Niaturbians believe that their ancestors wore 200 years ago, riding in coaches such as their ancestors use, or houses with snow on their roofs. And the Niaturbians are unwilling to say what these pictures have to do with the festival, guarding, as I suppose, some sacred mystery. And because all men must send these cards, the marketplace is filled with the crowd of those buying them, so that there is great labour and weariness. But having bought as many as they suppose to be sufficient, they return to their houses and find there the like cards which others have sent to them. And when they find cards from any to whom they also have sent cards, they throw them away and give thanks to the gods that this labour at least is over for another year. But when they find cards from any to whom they have not sent, then they beat their breasts and wail and utter curses against the sender. And, having sufficiently lamented their misfortune, they put on their boots again and go out into the fog and rain and buy a card for him also. And let this account suffice about Xmas cards. They also send gifts to one another, suffering the same things about the gifts as about the cards, or even worse. For every citizen has to guess the value of the gift which every friend will send to him, so that he may send one of equal value, whether he can afford it or not. And they buy as gifts for one another such things as no man ever bought for himself. For the sellers, understanding the custom, put forth all kinds of trumpery, and whatever, being useless and ridiculous, they have been unable to sell throughout the year, they now sell as an Xmas gift. And though the Niaturbians profess themselves to lack sufficient necessary things, such as metal, leather, wood, and paper, yet an incredible quantity of these things is wasted every year, being made into the gifts. But during these 50 days, the oldest, poorest, and most miserable of the citizens put on false beards and red robes, and walk about the marketplace, being disguised, in my opinion, as Cronos. And the sellers of gifts, no less than the purchasers, become pale and weary, because of the crowds and the fog, so that any man who came into a Niaturbian city at this season would think some great public calamity had fallen on Niaturb. This 50 days of preparation is called, in their barbarian speech, the Xmas Rush. But when the day of the festival comes, then most of the citizens, being exhausted with the rush, lie in bed till noon. But in the evening they eat 5 times as much supper as on other days, and, crowning themselves with crowns of paper, they become intoxicated. And on the day after Xmas they are very grave, being internally disordered by the supper and the drinking, and reckoning how much they have spent on gifts and on the wine. For wine is so dear among the Niaturbians that a man must swallow the worth of a talent before he is well intoxicated. Such, then, are their customs about the Xmas. But the few among the Niaturbians have also a festival, separate and to themselves, called Christmas, which is on the same day as Xmas. And those who keep Christmas, doing the opposite to the majority of the Niaturbians, rise early on that day with shining faces, and go before sunrise to certain temples, where they partake of a sacred feast. And in most of the temples they set out images of a fair woman with a newborn child on her knees, and certain animals and shepherds adoring the child. The reason of these images is given in a certain sacred story, which I know but do not repeat. But I myself conversed with a priest in one of these temples, and asked him why they kept Christmas on the same day as Xmas. for it appeared to me inconvenient. But the priest replied, It is not lawful, O stranger, for us to change the date of Christmas. But would that Zeus would put it into the minds of the Nyoterbians to keep Xmas at some other time, or not to keep it at all. For Xmas and the rush distract the minds even of the few from sacred things. And we indeed are glad that men should make merry at Christmas, but in Xmas there is no merriment left. And when I asked him why they endured the rush, he replied, It is, O stranger, a racket, using, as I suppose, the words of some oracle, and speaking unintelligibly to me, for a racket is an instrument which the barbarians use in a game called tennis. But what Hecateia says, that Xmas and Christmas are the same, is not credible. For first, the pictures which are stamped on the Xmas cards have nothing to do with the sacred story which the priests tell about Christmas. And secondly, the most part of the Nyoterbians, not believing the religion of the few, nevertheless send the gifts and cards and participate in the rush and drink wearing paper caps. But it is not likely that men, even being barbarians, should suffer so many and great things in honour of a god they do not believe in. And now, enough about Nyoterb. 114. Revival or Decay. Published in Punch, Volume 235, 9th of July, 1958, and reproduced in Undeceptions, 1971, and First and Second Things, 1985. But would you deny, said the headmaster, that there is, here in the West, a great, even growing, interest in religion? It is not the sort of question I find easy to answer. Great and growing would seem to involve statistics, and I had no statistics. I supposed there was a fairly widespread interest, but I didn't feel sure the headmaster was interpreting it correctly. In the days when most people had a religion, what he meant by an interest in religion could hardly have existed. For, of course, religious people, that is, people when they are being religious, are not interested in religion. Men who have gods worship those gods. It is the spectators who describe this as religion. The Maenads thought about Dionysus, not about religion. Mutatis mutandis, this goes for Christians too. The moment a man seriously accepts a deity, his interest in religion is at an end. He's got something else to think about. The ease with which we can now get an audience for a discussion of religion does not prove that more people are becoming religious. What it really proves is the existence of a large floating vote. Every conversion will reduce this potential audience. Once the climate of opinion allows such a floating vote to form, I see no reason why it should speedily diminish. Indecision, often very honest, is natural. It would be foolish, however, not to realize that it is also no hardship. Floating is a very agreeable operation. A decision either way costs something. Real Christianity and consistent atheism both make demands on a man. But to admit, on occasion and as possibilities, all the comforts of the one without its discipline, to enjoy all the liberty of the other without its philosophical and emotional abstinences, well, this may be honest, but there's no good pretending it is uncomfortable. And would you further deny, said the headmaster, that Christianity commands more respect in the most highly educated circles than it has done for centuries? The intelligentsia are coming over. Look at men like Maritain, like Bergson, like... But I didn't feel at all happy about this. Of course, the converted intellectual is a characteristic figure of our times. But this phenomenon would be more hopeful if it had not occurred at a moment when the intelligentsia, scientists apart, are losing all touch with and all influence over nearly the whole human race. Our most esteemed poets and critics are read by our most esteemed critics and poets, who don't usually like them much, and nobody else takes any notice. An increasing number of highly literate people simply ignore what the highbrows are doing. It says nothing to them. The highbrows, in return, ignore or insult them. Conversions from the intelligentsia are not, therefore, likely to be very widely influential. They may even raise a horrid suspicion that Christianity itself has become part of the general highbrow racket, has been adopted like surrealism and the pictures painted by chimpanzees as one more method of shocking the bourgeois. This would be dreadfully uncharitable, no doubt, but then the intelligentsia have said a great many uncharitable things about the others. Then again, boomed the headmaster, even where there is, or is as yet, no explicit religion, do we not see a vast rallying to the defence of those standards which, whether recognised or not, make part of our spiritual heritage? The Western, may I not say the Christian, values? We all winced. And to me, in particular, there came back the memory of a corrugated iron hut used as an RAF chapel, a few kneeling airmen, and a young chaplain uttering the prayer, "Teach us, O Lord, to love the things thou standest for." He was perfectly sincere, and I willingly believe that the things in question included something more and better than the Western values, whatever those may be. And yet, his words seemed to me to imply a point of view incompatible with Christianity, or indeed with any serious theism whatever. God is not, for it, the goal or end. He is, and how fortunate, enlightened, has or stands for the right ideals. He is valued for that reason. He ranks, admittedly, as a leader. But of course, a leader leads to something beyond himself. That something else is the real goal. This is miles away from, "Thou hast made us for thyself, and our heart has no rest till it comes to thee." The Maenads were more religious. "And the substitutes for religion are being discredited," continued the headmaster. "Science has become more a bogey than a god. The Marxist heaven on earth." And only the other day, a lady told me that a girl to whom she had mentioned death replied, "Oh, but by the time I'm that age, science will have done something about it." And then I remembered how often, in disputing before simple audiences, I had found the assured belief that whatever was wrong with man would, in the long run, and not so very long a run either, be put right by education. And that led me to think of all the approaches to religion I actually meet. An anonymous postcard tells me that I ought to be flogged at the cart's tail for professing to believe in the virgin birth. A distinguished literary atheist to whom I am introduced mutters, looks away, and walks swiftly to the far end of the room. An unknown American writes to ask me whether Elijah's fiery chariot was really a flying saucer. I encounter theosophists, British Israelites, spiritualists, pantheists. Why do people like the headmaster always talk about religion? Why not religions? We seethe with religions. Christianity, I am pleased to note, is one of them. I get letters from saints who have no notion they are any such thing, showing in every line radiant faith, joy, humility, and even humour in appalling suffering. I get others from converts who want to apologise for some small incivility they committed against me in print years ago. These bits and pieces are all the West I really know at first hand. They escape the headmaster's treatment. He speaks from books and articles. The real sanctities, hatreds, and lunacies which surround us are hardly represented there. Still less, the great negative factor. It is something more than ignorance, as he would understand the word. Most people's thinking lacks a dimension which he takes for granted. Two instances may make the distinction clear. Once, after I had said something on the air about natural law, an old colonel, obviously anima candida, wrote to say that this had interested him very much, and could I just tell him of some handy little brochure which dealt with the subject fully. That is ignorance, striking only in degree. Here is the other. A vet, a workman, and I were wearily stumbling about on a home guard patrol in the small hours. The vet and I got talking about the causes of wars, and arrived at the conclusion that we must expect them to recur. But, gasped the workman. There was a moment's silence, and he broke out, "But then what's the good of the ruddy world going on?" I got a very clear impression of what was happening. For the first time in his life, a really ultimate question was before him. the sort of thing we have been considering all our lives, the meaning of existence, had just broken upon him. It was a wholly new dimension. Is there a homogeneous West? I doubt it. Everything that can go on is going on all round us. Religions buzz about us like bees. A serious sex worship, quite different from the cheery lechery endemic in our species, is one of them. Traces of embryonic religions occur in science fiction. Meanwhile, as always, the Christian way too is followed. But nowadays, when it is not followed, it need not be feigned. That fact covers a good deal of what is called the decay of religion. Apart from that, is the present so very different from other ages, or the West from anywhere else? 115. Delinquents in the Snow. Published in Time and Tide, Volume 38, 7th of December, 1957, and reproduced in Undeceptions, 1971, and Christian Reunion, 1990. Voices off, outside the front door, annually remind us, usually at the most inconvenient moments, that the season of carols has come again. At my front door, they are, once every year, the voices of the local choir. On the 45 other annual occasions, they are those of boys or children who have not even tried to learn to sing or to memorize the words of the piece they are murdering. The instruments they play with real conviction are the doorbell and the knocker, and money is what they are after. I am pretty sure that some of them are the very same hooligans who trespass in my garden, rob my orchard, hack down my trees, and scream outside my windows, though everyone in the neighbourhood knows that there is serious illness in my family. I am afraid I deal with them badly in the capacity of waits. I neither forgive like a Christian, nor turn the dog on them like an indignant householder. I pay the blackmail. I give, but give ungraciously, and make the worst of both worlds. It would be silly to publish this fact, more property for a confessor's ear, if I did not think that this smouldering resentment against which I win so many battles but never win the war was at present very widely shared by law-abiding people. And heaven knows many of them have better cause to feel it than I. I have not been driven to suicide like Mr. Pilgrim. I am not mourning for a raped and murdered daughter whose murderer will be kept, partly at my expense, in a mental hospital till he gets out and catches some other child. My greatest grievance is trivial in comparison, but, as it raises all the issues, I will tell it. Not long ago, some of my young neighbours broke into a little pavilion or bungalow which stands in my garden, and stole several objects, curious weapons and an optical instrument. This time the police discovered who they were. As more than one of them had been convicted of similar crimes before, we had high hopes that some adequately deterrent sentence would be given. But I was warned, it'll all be no good if the old woman's on the bench. I had, of course, to attend the juvenile court, and all fell out pat as the warning had said. The, let us call her, elderly lady presided. It was abundantly proved that the crime had been planned and that it was done for gain. Some of the swag had already been sold. The elderly lady inflicted a small fine. That is, she punished not the culprits, but their parents. But what alarmed me more was her concluding speech to the prisoners. She told them that they must, they really must, give up these stupid pranks. Of course, I must not accuse the elderly lady of injustice. Justice has been so variously defined. If it means, as Thrasymachus thought, the interest of the stronger, she was very just, for she enforced her own will and that of the criminals, and they together are incomparably stronger than I. But if her intention was, and I do not doubt that the road on which such justice is leading us all is paved with good ones, to prevent these boys from growing up into confirmed criminals, I question whether her method was well judged. If they listened to her, we may hope they did not, what they carried away was the conviction that planned robbery for gain would be classified as a prank, a childishness which they might be expected to grow out of. A better way of leading them on without any sense of frontiers crossed, from mere inconsiderate romping and plundering orchards to burglary, arson, rape, and murder, would seem hard to imagine. This little incident seems to me characteristic of our age. Criminal law increasingly protects the criminal and ceases to protect his victim. One might fear that we were moving towards a dictatorship of the criminals, or, what is perhaps the same thing, mere anarchy. But that is not my fear. My fear is almost the opposite. According to the classical political theory of this country, we surrendered our right of self-protection to the state on condition that the state would protect us. Roughly, you promised not to stab your daughter's murderer on the understanding that the state would catch him and hang him. Of course, this was never true as a historical account of the genesis of the state. The power of the group over the individual is by nature unlimited, and the individual submits because he has to. The state, under favorable conditions, they have ceased, by defining that power, limits it and gives the individual a little freedom. But the classical theory morally grounds our obligation to civil obedience, explains why it is right, as well as unavoidable, to pay taxes, why it is wrong, as well as dangerous, to stab your daughter's murderer. At present, the very uncomfortable position is this. The state protects us less because it is unwilling to protect us against criminals at home, and manifestly grows less and less able to protect us against foreign enemies. At the same time, it demands from us more and more. We seldom had fewer rights and liberties, nor more burdens, and we get less security in return. While our obligations increase, their moral ground is taken away. And the question that torments me is how long flesh and blood will continue to endure it. There was even, not so long ago, a question whether they ought to. No one, I hope, thinks Dr. Johnson a barbarian. Yet he maintained that if, under a peculiarity of Scottish law, the murderer of a man's father escapes, the man might reasonably say, "I am amongst barbarians who refuse to do justice. I am therefore in a state of nature. I will stab the murderer of my father." This is recorded in Boswell's Journal of a Tour to the Hebrides, under the 22nd of August, 1773. Much more obviously, on these principles, when the state ceases to protect me from hooligans, I might reasonably, if I could, catch and thrash them myself. When the state cannot or will not protect, nature is come again, and the right of self-protection reverts to the individual. But of course, if I could and did, I should be prosecuted. The elderly lady and her kind, who are so merciful to theft, would have no mercy on me, and I should be pilloried in the gutter press as a sadist, by journalists who neither know nor care what that word, or any word, means. What I fear, however, is not, or not chiefly, sporadic outbreaks of individual vengeance. I am more afraid, our conditions being so like that of the South after the American Civil War, that some sort of Ku Klux Klan may appear, and that this might eventually develop into something like a right or central revolution. For those who suffer are chiefly the provident, the resolute, the men who want to work, who have built up, in the face of implacable discouragement, some sort of life worth preserving, and wish to preserve it. That most, by no means all, of them are middle class is not very relevant. They do not get their qualities from a class. They belong to that class because they have those qualities. For in a society like ours, no stock which has diligence, forethought, or talent, and is prepared to practice self-denial, is likely to remain proletarian for more than a generation. They are, in fact, the bearers of what little moral, intellectual, or economic vitality remains. They are not non-entities. There is a point at which their patience will snap. The elderly lady, if she read this article, would say I was threatening, linguistic nicety not being much in her line. If by a threat you mean, but then you don't know much English, the conjectural prediction of a highly undesirable event, then I threaten. But if by the word threat you imply that I wish for such a result, or would willingly contribute to it, then you are wrong. Revolutions seldom cure the evil against which they are directed. They always beget 100 others. Often they perpetuate the old evil under a new name, We may be sure that if a Ku Klux Klan arose, its ranks would soon be chiefly filled by the same sort of hooligans who provoked it. A right or central revolution would be as hypocritical, filthy, and ferocious as any other. My fear is lest we should be making it more probable. This may be judged an article unfit for the season of peace and goodwill. Yet there is a connection. Not all kinds of peace are compatible with all kinds of goodwill, nor do all those who say, "Peace, peace," inherit the blessing promised to the peacemakers. Matthew chapter 5, verse 9. The real pacificus is he who promotes peace, not he who gasses about it. Peace, peace, we won't be hard on you. It was only a boyish prank. You had a neurosis. Promise not to do it again. Out of this, in the long run, I do not think either goodwill or peace will come. Planting new primroses on the primrose path is no long-term benevolence. There, they're at it again. Hark, the Errol Hindgel sings. They're knocking louder. Well, they come but 50 times a year. Boxing Day is only 2.5 weeks ahead. Then, perhaps, we shall have a little quiet in which to remember the birth of Christ. 116. Willing Slaves of the Welfare State. Originally published in The Observer, 20th of July 1958, as number 2 of the series, Is Progress Possible? This was reproduced in Undeceptions, 1971, and Timeless at Heart, 1991, and is now in Compelling Reason, 1998. Progress means movement in a desired direction, and we do not all desire the same things for our species. In Possible Worlds, Professor Haldane pictured a future in which man, foreseeing that Earth would soon be uninhabitable, adapted himself for migration to Venus by drastically modifying his physiology and abandoning justice, pity, and happiness. The desire here is for mere survival. Now, I care far more how humanity lives than how long. Progress, for me, means increasing goodness and happiness of individual lives. For the species, as for each man, mere longevity seems to me a contemptible idea. I therefore go even further than C.P. Snow in removing the H-bomb from the center of the picture. Like him, I am not certain whether if it killed one-third of us, the one-third I belong to, this would be a bad thing for the remainder. Like him, I don't think it will kill us all. But suppose it did. As a Christian, I take it for granted that human history will someday end, and I am offering omniscience no advice as to the best date for that consummation. I am more concerned by what the bomb is already doing. One meets young people who make the threat of it a reason for poisoning every pleasure and evading every duty in the present. Didn't they know that, bomb or no bomb, all men die? Many in horrible ways. There is no good moping and sulking about it. Having removed what I think a red herring, I return to the real question. Are people becoming, or likely to become, better or happier? Obviously, this allows only the most conjectural answer. Most individual experience, and there is no other kind, never gets into the news, let alone the history books. One has an imperfect grasp even of one's own. We are reduced to generalities. Even among these, it is hard to strike a balance. Sir Charles enumerates many real ameliorations. Against these we must set Hiroshima, black and tans, Gestapo, Ogpu, brainwashing, the Russian slave camps. Perhaps we grow kinder to children, but then we grow less kind to the old. Any GP will tell you that even prosperous people refuse to look after their parents. Can't they be got into some sort of home, says Goneril. More useful, I think, than an attempt at balancing, is the reminder that most of these phenomena, good and bad, are made possible by two things. These two will probably determine most of what happens to us for some time. The first is the advance and increasing application of science. As a means to the ends I care for, this is neutral. We shall grow able to cure and to produce more diseases. Bacterial war, not bombs, might bring down the curtain. to alleviate and to inflict more pains, to husband or to waste the resources of the planet more extensively. We can become either more beneficent or more mischievous. My guess is that we shall do both, mending one thing and marring another, removing old miseries and producing new ones, safeguarding ourselves here and endangering ourselves there. The second is the changed relation between government and subjects. Sir Charles mentions our new attitude to crime. I will mention the trainloads of Jews delivered at the German gas chambers. It seems shocking to suggest a common element, but I think one exists. On the humanitarian view, all crime is pathological. It demands not retributive punishment, but cure. This separates the criminal's treatment from the concepts of justice and desert. A just cure is meaningless. On the old view, public opinion might protest against the punishment. It protested against our old penal code as excessive, more than the man deserved. An ethical question on which anyone might have an opinion. But a remedial treatment can be judged only by the probability of its success. A technical question on which only experts can speak. Thus, the criminal ceases to be a person, a subject of rights and duties, and becomes merely an object on which society can work. And this is, in principle, how Hitler treated the Jews. They were objects, killed not for ill desert, but because, on his theories, they were a disease in society. If society can mend, remake, and unmake men at its pleasure may, of course, be humane or homicidal. The difference is important. But either way, rulers have become owners. Observe how the humane attitude to crime could operate. If crimes are diseases, why should diseases be treated differently from crimes? And who but the experts can define disease? One school of psychology regards my religion as a neurosis. If this neurosis ever becomes inconvenient to the government, what is to prevent my being subjected to a compulsory cure? It may be painful, treatments sometimes are. But it will be no use asking, what have I done to deserve this? The straightener will reply, but, my dear fellow, no one's blaming you. We no longer believe in retributive justice. We're healing you. This would be no more than an extreme application of the political philosophy implicit in most modern communities. It has stolen on us unawares. Two wars necessitated vast curtailments of liberty, and we have grown, though grumblingly, accustomed to our chains. The increasing complexity and precariousness of our economic life have forced government to take over many spheres of activity once left to choice or chance. Our intellectuals have surrendered first to the slave philosophy of Hegel, then to Marx, finally to the linguistic analysts. As a result, classical political theory, with its stoical, Christian, and juristic key conceptions, natural law, the value of the individual, the rights of man, has died. The modern state exists not to protect our rights, but to do us good, or to make us good. Anyway, to do something to us or make us something. Hence the new name, leaders, for those who were once rulers. We are less their subjects than their wards, pupils, or domestic animals. There is nothing left of which we can say to them, mind your own business. Our whole lives are their business. I write they because it seems childish not to recognize that actual government is and always must be oligarchical. Our effective masters must be more than one and fewer than all. But the oligarchs begin to regard us in a new way. Here, I think, lies our real dilemma. Probably we cannot, certainly we shall not, retrace our steps. We are tamed animals, some with kind, some with cruel masters, and should probably starve if we got out of our cage. That is one horn of the dilemma. But in an increasingly planned society, how much of what I value can survive? That is the other horn. I believe a man is happier, and happy in a richer way, if he has the freeborn mind. But I doubt whether he can have this without economic independence, which the new society is abolishing. For economic independence allows an education not controlled by government. and in adult life it is the man who needs and asks nothing of the government, who can criticize its acts and snap his fingers at its ideology. Read Montaigne. That's the voice of a man with his legs under his own table, eating the mutton and turnips raised on his own land. Who will talk like that when the state is everyone's schoolmaster and employer? Admittedly, when man was untamed, such liberty belonged only to the few. I know. Hence the horrible suspicion that our only choice is between societies with few freemen and societies with none. Again, the new oligarchy must more and more base its claim to plan us on its claim to knowledge. If we are to be mothered, mother must know best. This means they must increasingly rely on the advice of scientists, till in the end the politicians proper become merely the scientists' puppets. Technocracy is the form to which planned society must tend. Now I dread specialists in power because they are specialists, speaking outside their special subjects. Let scientists tell us about sciences. But government involves questions about the good for man and justice and what things are worth having at what price. And on these, a scientific training gives a man's opinion no added value. Let the doctor tell me I shall die unless I do so and so. But whether life is worth having on those terms is no more a question for him than for any other man. Thirdly, I do not like the pretensions of government, the grounds on which it demands my obedience, to be pitched too high. I don't like the medicine man's magical pretensions, nor the Bourbon's divine right. This is not solely because I disbelieve in magic and in Bossuet's politique. I believe in God, but I detest theocracy. For every government consists of mere men and is, strictly viewed, a makeshift. If it adds to its commands, "Thus saith the Lord," it lies, and lies dangerously. On just the same ground, I dread government in the name of science. That is how tyrannies come in. In every age, the men who want us under their thumb, if they have any sense, will put forward the particular pretension which the hopes and fears of that age render most potent. They cash in. It has been magic. It has been Christianity. Now it will certainly be science. Perhaps the real scientists may not think much of the tyrant's science. They didn't think much of Hitler's racial theories or Stalin's biology. But they can be muzzled. We must give full weight to Sir Charles's reminder that millions in the East are still half-starved. To these, my fears would seem very unimportant. A hungry man thinks about food, not freedom. We must give full weight to the claim that nothing but science, and science globally applied and therefore unprecedented government controls, can produce full bellies and medical care for the whole human race. Nothing, in short, but a world welfare state. It is a full admission of these truths which impresses upon me the extreme peril of humanity at present. We have, on the one hand, a desperate need, hunger, sickness, and the dread of war. We have, on the other, the conception of something that might meet it, omnicompetent global technocracy. Are not these the ideal opportunity for enslavement? This is how it has entered before. A desperate need, real or apparent, in the one party, a power, real or apparent, to relieve it in the other. In the ancient world, individuals have sold themselves as slaves in order to eat. So in society. Here is a witch doctor who can save us from the sorcerers, a warlord who can save us from the barbarians, a church that can save us from hell. Give them what they ask, give ourselves to them bound and blindfold, if only they will. Perhaps the terrible bargain will be made again. We cannot blame men for making it. We can hardly wish them not to. Yet we can hardly bear that they should. The question about progress has become the question whether we can discover any way of submitting to the worldwide paternalism of a technocracy without losing all the personal privacy and independence. Is there any possibility of getting the super welfare state's honey and avoiding the sting? Let us make no mistake about the sting. The Swedish sadness is only a foretaste. To live his life in his own way, to call his house his castle, to enjoy the fruits of his own labour, to educate his children as his conscience directs, to save for their prosperity after his death. These are wishes deeply ingrained in white and civilized man. Their realization is almost as necessary to our virtues as to our happiness. From their total frustration, disastrous results, both moral and psychological, might follow. All this threatens us, even if the form of society which our needs point to should prove an unparalleled success. But is that certain? What assurance have we that our masters will, or can, keep the promise which induced us to sell ourselves? Let us not be deceived by phrases about man taking charge of his own destiny. All that can really happen is that some men will take charge of the destiny of others. They will be simply men, none perfect, some greedy, cruel, and dishonest. The more completely we are planned, the more powerful they will be. Have we discovered some new reason why, this time, power should not corrupt as it has done before? 117. Screwtape proposes a toast. Initially published in Great Britain as part of a hardback entitled The Screwtape Letters and Screwtape Proposes a Toast, 1961, and later in paperback as Screwtape Proposes a Toast, 1965. It also appeared in the USA, first as an article in the Saturday Evening Post, 232, 19th of December 1959, and then in a hardback called The World's Last Night, 1960. It is now in Screwtape Proposes a Toast, 1998, and further details about it can be found there. I was often asked or advised to add to the original Screwtape Letters, but for many years I felt not the least inclination to do it. Though I had never written anything more easily, I never wrote with less enjoyment. The ease came, no doubt, from the fact that the device of diabolical letters, once you have thought of it, exploits itself spontaneously, like Swift's Big and Little Men, or the medical and ethical philosophy of Erewhon, as Anstey's Garuda Stone. It would run away with you for 1,000 pages if you gave it its head. But though it was easy to twist one's mind into the diabolical attitude, it was not fun, or not for long. The strain produced a sort of spiritual cramp. The world into which I had to project myself while I spoke through Screwtape was all dust, grit, thirst, and itch. Every trace of beauty, freshness, and geniality had to be excluded. It almost smothered me before I was done. It would have smothered my readers if I had prolonged it. I had, moreover, a sort of grudge against my book for not being a different book which no one could write. Ideally, Screwtape's advice to Wormwood should have been balanced by archangelical advice to the patient's guardian angel. Without this, the picture of human life is lopsided. But who could supply the deficiency? Even if a man, and he would have to be a far better man than I, could scale the spiritual heights required, what answerable style could he use? For the style would really be part of the content. Mere advice would be no good. Every sentence would have to smell of heaven. And nowadays, even if you could write prose like Traherne's, you wouldn't be allowed to, for the canon of functionalism has disabled literature for half its functions. At bottom, every ideal of style dictates not only how we should say things, but what sort of things we may say. Then, as years went on, and the stifling experience of writing the letters became a weaker memory, reflections on this and that which seemed somehow to demand Screwtapian treatment began to occur to me. I was resolved never to write another letter. The idea of something like a lecture or address hovered vaguely in my mind, now forgotten, now recalled, never written. Then came an invitation from the Saturday Evening Post, and that pressed the trigger. CSL. The scene is in hell, at the annual dinner of the Tempter's Training College for Young Devils. The principal, Dr. Slubgob, has just proposed the health of the guests. Screwtape, who is the guest of honour, rises to reply. Mr. Principal, your eminence, your disgraces, my thorns, shadies, and gentle devils. It is customary on these occasions for the speaker to address himself chiefly to those among you who have just graduated, and who will very soon be posted to official temptorships on earth. It is a custom I willingly obey. I well remember with what trepidation I awaited my own first appointment. I hope and believe that each one of you has the same uneasiness tonight. Your career is before you. Hell expects and demands that it should be, as mine was, one of unbroken success. If it is not, you know what awaits you. I have no wish to reduce the wholesome and realistic element of terror, the unremitting anxiety which must act as the lash and spur to your endeavours. How often you will envy the humans their faculty of sleep. Yet at the same time, I would wish to put before you a moderately encouraging view of the strategical situation as a whole. Your dreaded principal has included, in a speech full of points, something like an apology for the banquet which he has set before us. Well, gentle devils, no one blames him. But it would be vain to deny that the human souls on whose anguish we have been feasting tonight were of pretty poor quality. Not all the most skilful cookery of our tormentors could make them better than insipid. Oh, to get one's teeth again into a Farinata, a Henry VIII, or even a Hitler. There was real crackling there, something to crunch, a rage, an egotism, a cruelty only just less robust than our own. It put up a delicious resistance to being devoured. It warmed your innards when you'd got it down. Instead of this, what have we had tonight? There was a municipal authority with graft sauce. But personally, I could not detect in him the flavour of a really passionate and brutal avarice such as delighted one in the great tycoons of the last century. Was he not unmistakably a little man, a creature of the petty rake-off pocketed with a petty joke in private and denied with the stalest platitudes in his public utterances? A grubby little nonentity who had drifted into corruption, only just realising that he was corrupt, and chiefly because everyone else did it. Then there was the lukewarm casserole of adulterers. Could you find in it any trace of a fully inflamed, defiant, rebellious, insatiable lust? I couldn't. They all tasted to me like undersexed morons who had blundered or trickled into the wrong beds in automatic response to sexy advertisements, or to make themselves feel modern and emancipated, or to reassure themselves about their virility or their normalcy, or even because they had nothing else to do. Frankly, to me, who have tasted Messalina and Casanova, they were nauseating. The trade unionist, garnished with claptrap, was perhaps a shade better. He had done some real harm. He had, not quite unknowingly, worked for bloodshed, famine, and the extinction of liberty. Yes, in a way. But what a way! He thought of those ultimate objectives so little. Towing the party line, self-importance, and above all, mere routine, were what really dominated his life. But now comes the point. Gastronomically, all this is deplorable. But I hope none of us puts gastronomy first. Is it not, in another and far more serious way, full of hope and promise? Consider, first, the mere quantity. The quality may be wretched, but we never had souls of a sort in more abundance. And then the triumph. We are tempted to say that such souls, or such residual puddles of what once was soul, are hardly worth damning. Yes, but the enemy, for whatever inscrutable and perverse reason, thought them worth trying to save. Believe me, he did. You youngsters who have not yet been on active service have no idea with what labour, with what delicate skill, each of these miserable creatures was finally captured. The difficulty lay in their very smallness and flabbiness. Here were vermin so muddled in mind, so passively responsive to environment, that it was very hard to raise them to that level of clarity and deliberateness at which mortal sin becomes possible. To raise them just enough. But not that fatal millimetre of too much. For then, of course, all would possibly have been lost. They might have seen, they might have repented. On the other hand, if they had been raised too little, they would very possibly have qualified for limbo, as creatures suitable neither for heaven nor for hell, things that, having failed to make the grade, are allowed to sink into a more or less contented subhumanity forever. In each individual choice of what the enemy would call the wrong turning, such creatures are at first hardly, if at all, in a state of full spiritual responsibility. They do not understand either the source or the real character of the prohibitions they are breaking. Their consciousness hardly exists apart from the social atmosphere that surrounds them. And, of course, we have contrived that their very language should be all smudge and blur. What would be a bribe in someone else's profession is a tip or a present in theirs. The first job of their tempters was to hearten these choices of the hellward roads into a habit by steady repetition. But then, and this was all important, to turn the habit into a principle the creature is prepared to defend. After that, all will go well. Conformity to the social environment, at first merely instinctive or even mechanical, how should a jelly not conform, now becomes an unacknowledged creed or ideal of togetherness or being like folks. Mere ignorance of the law they break now turns into a vague theory about it. Remember, they know no history. A theory expressed by calling it conventional or Puritan or bourgeois morality. Thus gradually there comes to exist at the centre of the creature a hard, tight, settled core of resolution to go on being what it is, and even to resist moods that might tend to alter it. It is a very small core, not at all reflective, they are too ignorant, nor defiant, their emotional and imaginative poverty excludes that, almost in its own way prim and demure, like a pebble or a very young cancer. But it will serve our turn. Here at last is a real and deliberate, though not fully articulate, rejection of what the enemy calls grace. These, then, are two welcome phenomena. First, the abundance of our captures, however tasteless our fare, we are in no danger of famine. And secondly, the triumph. The skill of our tempters has never stood higher. But the third moral, which I have not yet drawn, is the most important of all. The sort of souls on whose despair and ruin we have, well, I won't say feasted, but at any rate subsisted, tonight, are increasing in numbers and will continue to increase. Our advices from lower command assure us that this is so. Our directives warn us to orient all our tactics in view of this situation. The great sinners, those in whom vivid and genial passions have been pushed beyond the bounds, and in whom an immense concentration of will has been devoted to objects which the enemy abhors, will not disappear. But they will grow rarer. Our catches will be ever more numerous, but they will consist increasingly of trash, trash which we should once have thrown to Cerberus and the hellhounds as unfit for diabolical consumption. And there are two things I want you to understand about this. First, that however depressing it may seem, it is really a change for the better. And secondly, I would draw your attention to the means by which it has been brought about. It is a change for the better. The great and toothsome sinners are made out of the very same material as those horrible phenomena, the great saints. The virtual disappearance of such material may mean insipid meals for us. But is it not utter frustration and famine for the enemy? He did not create the humans, he did not become one of them and die among them by torture, in order to produce candidates for limbo, failed humans. He wanted to make saints, gods, things like himself. Is the dullness of your present fare not a very small price to pay for the delicious knowledge that his whole great experiment is petering out? But not only that. As the great sinners grow fewer and the majority lose all individuality, the great sinners become far more effective agents for us. Every dictator, or even demagogue, almost every film star or crooner, can now draw tens of thousands of the human sheep with him. They give themselves, what there is of them, to him, in him to us. There may come a time when we shall have no need to bother about individual temptation at all, except for the few. Catch the bellwether, and his whole flock comes after him. But do you realize how we have succeeded in reducing so many of the human race to the level of ciphers? This has not come about by accident. It has been our answer, and a magnificent answer it is, to one of the most serious challenges we ever had to face. Let me recall to your minds what the human situation was in the latter half of the 19th century. the period at which I ceased to be a practicing tempter, and was rewarded with an administrative post. The great movement towards liberty and equality among men had by then borne solid fruit and grown mature. Slavery had been abolished. The American War of Independence had been won. The French Revolution had succeeded. Religious toleration was almost everywhere on the increase. In that movement, there had originally been many elements which were in our favour. Much atheism, much anti-clericalism, much envy and thirst for revenge, even some rather absurd attempts to revive paganism were mixed in it. It was not easy to determine what our own attitude should be. On the one hand, it was a bitter blow to us, it still is, that any sort of men who had been hungry should be fed, or any who had long worn chains should have them struck off. But on the other hand, there was in the movement so much rejection of faith, so much materialism, secularism, and hatred, that we felt we were bound to encourage it. But by the latter part of the century, the situation was much simpler, and also much more ominous. In the English sector, where I saw most of my frontline service, a horrible thing had happened. The enemy, with his usual sleight of hand, had largely appropriated this progressive or liberalizing movement and perverted it to his own ends. Very little of its old anti-Christianity remained. The dangerous phenomenon called Christian socialism was rampant. Factory owners of the good old type who grew rich on sweated labour, instead of being assassinated by their workpeople, we could have used that, were being frowned upon by their own class. The rich were increasingly giving up their powers, not in the face of revolution and compulsion, but in obedience to their own consciences. As for the poor who benefited by this, they were behaving in a most disappointing fashion. Instead of using their new liberties, as we reasonably hoped and expected, for massacre, rape, and looting, or even for perpetual intoxication, they were perversely engaged in becoming cleaner, more orderly, more thrifty, better educated, and even more virtuous. Believe me, gentle devils, the threat of something like a really healthy state of society seemed then perfectly serious. Thanks to our father below, the threat was averted. Our counterattack was on two levels. On the deepest level, our dealers contrived to call into full life an element which had been implicit in the movement from its earliest days. Hidden in the heart of this striving for liberty, there was also a deep hatred of personal freedom. That invaluable man Rousseau first revealed it. In his Perfect Democracy, you remember, only the state religion is permitted, slavery is restored, and the individual is told that he has really willed, though he didn't know it, whatever the government tells him to do. From that starting point, via Hegel, another indispensable propagandist on our side, we easily contrived both the Nazi and the communist state. Even in England we were pretty successful. I heard the other day that in that country a man could not, without a permit, cut down his own tree with his own axe, make it into planks with his own saw, and use the planks to build a tool shed in his own garden. Such was our counterattack on one level. You, who are mere beginners, will not be entrusted with work of that kind. You will be attached as tempters to private persons. Against them, or through them, our counterattack takes a different form. Democracy is the word with which you must lead them by the nose. The good work which our philological experts have already done in the corruption of human language makes it unnecessary to warn you that they should never be allowed to give this word a clear and definable meaning. They won't. It will never occur to them that democracy is properly the name of a political system, even a system of voting, and that this has only the most remote and tenuous connection with what you are trying to sell them. Nor, of course, must they ever be allowed to raise Aristotle's question whether democratic behaviour means the behaviour that democracies like, or the behaviour that will preserve a democracy. For if they did, it could hardly fail to occur to them that these need not be the same. You are to use the word purely as an incantation, if you like, purely for its selling power. It is a name they venerate. And, of course, it is connected with the political ideal that men should be equally treated. You then make a stealthy transition in their minds from this political ideal to a factual belief that all men are equal, especially the man you are working on. As a result, you can use the word democracy to sanction in his thought the most degrading and also the least enjoyable of all human feelings. You can get him to practice, not only without shame, but with a positive glow of self-approval, conduct which, if undefended by the magic word, would be universally derided. The feeling I mean is, of course, that which prompts a man to say, "I'm as good as you." The first and most obvious advantage is that you thus induce him to enthrone at the center of his life a good, solid, resounding lie. I don't mean merely that his statement is false, in fact, that he is no more equal to everyone he meets in kindness, honesty, and good sense than in height or waist measurement. I mean that he does not believe it himself. No man who says, "I'm as good as you," believes it. He would not say it if he did. The Saint Bernard never says it to the toy dog, nor the scholar to the dunce, nor the employable to the bum, nor the pretty woman to the plain. The claim to equality, outside the strictly political field, is made only by those who feel themselves to be in some way inferior. What it expresses is precisely the itching, smarting, writhing awareness of an inferiority which the patient refuses to accept, and therefore resents. Yes, and therefore resents every kind of superiority in others, denigrates it, wishes its annihilation. Presently, he suspects every mere difference of being a claim to superiority. No one must be different from himself in voice, clothes, manners, recreations, choice of food. Here is someone who speaks English rather more clearly and euphoniously than I. It must be a vile, upstage la-di-da affectation. Here's a fellow who says he doesn't like hot dogs, thinks himself too good for them, no doubt. Here's a man who hasn't turned on the jukebox. He must be one of those highbrows and is doing it to show off. If they were the right sort of chaps, they'd be like me. They've no business to be different. It's undemocratic. Now, this useful phenomenon is in itself by no means new. Under the name of envy, it has been known to the humans for thousands of years. But hitherto, they always regarded it as the most odious and also the most comical of vices. Those who were aware of feeling it felt it with shame. Those who were not gave it no quarter in others. The delightful novelty of the present situation is that you can sanction it, make it respectable and even laudable by the incantatory use of the word democratic. Under the influence of this incantation, those who are in any or every way inferior can labour more wholeheartedly and successfully than ever before to pull down everyone else to their own level. But that is not all. Under the same influence, those who come, or could come, nearer to a full humanity actually draw back from it for fear of being undemocratic. I am credibly informed that young humans now sometimes suppress an incipient taste for classical music or good literature because it might prevent their being like folks. That people who would really wish to be and are offered the grace which would enable them to be honest, chaste, or temperate, refuse it. To accept might make them different, might offend again the way of life, take them out of togetherness, impair their integration with the group. They might, horror of horrors, become individuals. All is summed up in the prayer which a young female human is said to have uttered recently, "O God, make me a normal 20th century girl." Thanks to our labours, this will mean, increasingly, make me a minx, a moron, and a parasite. And meanwhile, as a delightful byproduct, the fewer every day, who will not be made normal and regular and like folks and integrated, increasingly tend to become in reality the prigs and cranks which the rabble would, in any case, have believed them to be. For suspicion often creates what it suspects. Since whatever I do, the neighbours are going to think me a witch or a communist agent, I might as well be hanged for a sheep as a lamb and become one in reality. As a result, we now have an intelligentsia which, though very small, is very useful to the cause of hell. But that is a mere byproduct. What I want to fix your attention on is the vast overall movement towards the discrediting and finally the elimination of every kind of human excellence, moral, cultural, social, or intellectual. And is it not pretty to notice how democracy, in the incantatory sense, is now doing for us the work that was once done by the most ancient dictatorships, and by the same methods? You remember how one of the Greek dictators, they called them tyrants then, sent an envoy to another dictator to ask his advice about the principles of government. The second dictator led the envoy into a field of corn, and there he snicked off with his cane the top of every stalk that rose an inch or so above the general level. The moral was plain. Allow no preeminence among your subjects. Let no man live who is wiser or better or more famous or even handsomer than the mass. Cut them all down to a level, all slaves, all ciphers, all nobodies, all equals. Thus tyrants could practice, in a sense, democracy. But now democracy can do the same work without any other tyranny than her own. No one need now go through the field with a cane. The little stalks will now of themselves bite the tops off the big ones. The big ones are beginning to bite off their own in their desire to be like stalks. I have said that to secure the damnation of these little souls, these creatures that have almost ceased to be individual, is a laborious and tricky work. But if proper pains and skill are expended, you can be fairly confident of the result. The great sinners seem easier to catch, but then they are incalculable. After you have played them for 70 years, the enemy may snatch them from your claws in the 71st. They are capable, you see, of real repentance. They are conscious of real guilt. They are, if things take the wrong turn, as ready to defy the social pressures around them for the enemy's sake as they were to defy them for ours. It is in some ways more troublesome to track and swat an evasive wasp than to shoot, at close range, a wild elephant. But the elephant is more troublesome if you miss. My own experience, as I have said, was mainly on the English sector, and I still get more news from it than from any other. It may be that what I am now going to say will not apply so fully to the sectors in which some of you may be operating, but you can make the necessary adjustments when you get there. Some application it will almost certainly have. If it has too little, you must labour to make the country you are dealing with more like what England already is. In that promising land, the spirit of "I'm as good as you" has already become something more than a generally social influence. It begins to work itself into their educational system. How far its operations there have gone at the present moment, I would not like to say with certainty. Nor does it matter. Once you have grasped the tendency, you can easily predict its future developments, especially as we ourselves will play our part in the developing. The basic principle of the new education is to be that dunces and idlers must not be made to feel inferior to intelligent and industrious pupils. That would be undemocratic. These differences between the pupils, for they are obviously and nakedly individual differences, must be disguised. This can be done on various levels. At universities, examinations must be framed so that nearly all the students get good marks. Entrance examinations must be framed so that all, or nearly all, citizens can go to universities, whether they have any power or wish to profit by higher education or not. At schools, the children who are too stupid or lazy to learn languages and mathematics and elementary science can be set to doing the things that children used to do in their spare time. Let them, for example, make mud pies and call it modelling. But all the time, there must be no faintest hint that they are inferior to the children who are at work. Whatever nonsense they are engaged in must have, I believe the English already use the phrase, parity of esteem. An even more drastic scheme is not impossible. Children who are fit to proceed to a higher class may be artificially kept back because the others would get a trauma. Beelzebub, what a useful word, by being left behind. The bright pupil thus remains democratically fettered to his own age group throughout his school career, and a boy who would be capable of tackling Aeschylus or Dante sits listening to his coevals attempts to spell out, "A cat sat on the mat." In a word, we may reasonably hope for the virtual abolition of education when I'm as good as you has fully had its way. All incentives to learn and all penalties for not learning will vanish. The few who might want to learn will be prevented. Who are they to overtop their fellows? And anyway, the teachers, or should I say nurses, will be far too busy reassuring the dunces and patting them on the back to waste any time on real teaching. We shall no longer have to plan and toil to spread imperturbable conceit and incurable ignorance among men. The little vermin themselves will do it for us. Of course, this would not follow unless all education became state education. But it will. That is part of the same movement. Penal taxes, designed for that purpose, are liquidating the middle class, the class who were prepared to save and spend and make sacrifices in order to have their children privately educated. The removal of this class, besides linking up with the abolition of education, is, fortunately, an inevitable effect of the spirit that says, I'm as good as you. This was, after all, the social group which gave to the humans the overwhelming majority of their scientists, physicians, philosophers, theologians, poets, artists, composers, architects, jurists, and administrators. If ever there was a bunch of tall stalks that needed their tops knocked off, it was surely they. As an English politician remarked not long ago, a democracy does not want great men. It would be idle to ask of such a creature whether by want it means need or like, but you had better be clear, for here Aristotle's question comes up again. We, in hell, would welcome the disappearance of democracy in the strict sense of that word, the political arrangement, so-called. Like all forms of government, it often works to our advantage, but on the whole, less often than other forms. And what we must realize is that democracy, in the diabolical sense, I'm as good as you, being like folks, togetherness, is the finest instrument we could possibly have for extirpating political democracies from the face of the earth. For democracy, or the democratic spirit, diabolical sense, leads to a nation without great men, a nation mainly of subliterates, morally flaccid from lack of discipline in youth, full of the cocksureness which flattery breeds on ignorance, and soft from lifelong pampering. And that is what hell wishes every democratic people to be. For when such a nation meets in conflict, a nation where children have been made to work at school, where talent is placed in high posts, and where the ignorant mass are allowed no say at all in public affairs, only one result is possible. One democracy was surprised lately when it found that Russia had got ahead of it in science. What a delicious specimen of human blindness! If the whole tendency of their society is opposed to every sort of excellence, why did they expect their scientists to excel? It is our function to encourage the behavior, the manners, the whole attitude of mind which democracies naturally like and enjoy, because these are the very things which, if unchecked, will destroy democracy. You would almost wonder that even humans don't see it themselves. Even if they don't read Aristotle, that would be undemocratic, you would have thought the French Revolution would have taught them that the behavior aristocrats naturally like is not the behavior that preserves aristocracy. They might then have applied the same principle to all forms of government. But I would not end on that note. I would not, hell forbid, encourage in your own minds that delusion which you must carefully foster in the minds of your human victims. I mean the delusion that the fate of nations is, in itself, more important than that of individual souls. The overthrow of free peoples and the multiplication of slave states are for us a means, besides, of course, being fun, but the real end is the destruction of individuals. For only individuals can be saved or damned, can become sons of the enemy or food for us. The ultimate value, for us, of any revolution, war, or famine lies in the individual anguish, treachery, hatred, rage, and despair which it may produce. I'm as good as you is a useful means for the destruction of democratic societies. But it has a far deeper value as an end in itself, as a state of mind which, necessarily excluding humility, charity, contentment, and all the pleasures of gratitude or admiration, turns a human being away from almost every road which might finally lead him to heaven.
But now for the pleasantest part of my duty. It falls to my lot to propose on behalf of the guests the health of Principal Slubgob and the Tempter's Training College. Fill your glasses. What is this I see? What is this delicious bouquet I inhale? Can it be? Mr. Principal, I unsay all my hard words about the dinner. I see and smell that even under wartime conditions the college cellar still has a few dozen of sound old vintage Pharisee. Well, well, well. This is like old times. Hold it beneath your nostrils for a moment, gentle devils. Hold it up to the light. Look at those fiery streaks that writhe and tangle in its dark heart, as if they were contending. And so they are. You know how this wine is blended? Different types of Pharisee have been harvested, trodden, and fermented together to produce its subtle flavour. Types that were most antagonistic to one another on earth. Some were all rules and relics and rosaries. Others were all drab clothes, long faces, and petty traditional abstinences from wine or cards or the theatre. Both had in common their self-righteousness, and the almost infinite distance between their actual outlook and anything the enemy really is or commands. The wickedness of other religions was the really live doctrine in the religion of each. Slander was its gospel, and denigration its litany. How they hated each other up there where the sun shone! How much more they hate each other now that they are forever conjoined, but not reconciled. Their astonishment, their resentment at the combination, the festering of their eternally impenitent spite, passing into our spiritual digestion, will work like fire. Dark fire. All said and done, my friends, it will be an ill day for us if what most humans mean by religion ever vanishes from the earth. It can still send us the truly delicious sins. The fine flower of unholiness can grow only in the close neighbourhood of the holy. Nowhere do we tempt so successfully as on the very steps of the altar. Your Eminence, your disgraces, my thorns, shadies, and gentle devils, I give you the toast of Principal Slubgob and the College. This concludes the reading of Some Everyday Thoughts by C.S. Lewis, edited by Leslie Walmsley. Copyright 2000 by C.S. Lewis PTE Limited. Compilation copyright 2000 by Leslie Walmsley. This book was read by Ralph Cosham. The production and sale of the recorded version is licensed by the C.S. Lewis Company Limited and was produced in 2013 by Blackstone Audio Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.